welcome to the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast. And today, as we record, it is March 27th, 2024, and I'm here with author Herman Hunter. Herman P. Hunter, you might see it like that. And Herman, let's get to know you a little bit. What do you write?
I write fantasy. I call it Christian fantasy, but it's technically Christian-esque fantasy. It's, you know, just regular swords and sorcery type stuff, but with some Christian elements thrown in. And I call it a mixture of like Dungeons and Dragons, Lord of the Rings, H.P. Lovecraft, and the Bible, kind of all thrown together.
Interesting. So, Go ahead.
Yeah, I have two books out. The first one is The Revenant in the Tomb, and that was my debut, and that was a novella. There's a long story about that one. And then the second one was The Wizard's Stone, which I released last year, early in March last year. And my next release is going to actually be a follow-up to The Revenant in the Tomb based on audience requests and demands. So...
Okay. Yeah. And I'm looking at your author page right now. So The Revenant in the Tomb was a novella.
Yeah.
Tell me again, The Wizard's Stone is.
The Wizard's Stone is a novel. It's roughly 82,000 words. And it's about a wizard's apprentice that's sent on a dangerous mission halfway across the, and has to travel halfway across the
world. Okay. And your next one is The Revenant and the Cult.
Yep. Revenant and the Cult. And I actually broke it up into two books. The Revenant and the Cult, book one, which is called The Trapper and the Missing Spy. And then the next one is The Revenant and the Cult, book two, The Terror in the Witchwood. And I'm going to be releasing the first book in late May. And then hopefully I'll be able to release the second book in late September, early October.
Okay. Cool.
I actually wrote it as one cohesive book, but there was lots of reasons why I busted it apart, and I actually talk about it in the foreword. But it felt like two separate books, so I decided to just split it in half, and probably be a really big mistake, like lots of other things I've done self-publishing.
Oh, it's always hard to know when you're in the middle of it, right? So how long did you say Revenant in the Tomb is?
Revenant in the Tomb is 39,000 words. Actually, 39,500. 500 short from technically being enough.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
For context, for anybody who's listening who may not be aware, novel length typically is considered to start at 40,000 words. He's just barely shy of that. And to put this in more context... Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone or the Philosopher's Stone was about 80,000 words. I don't remember exactly. Maybe it was 82,000, but it was in the neighborhood. So 80,000 words is a pretty common length for novels these days, but starts at 40,000.
Yeah. In fantasy, it's almost like everybody wants something that's like 200,000 words or longer. So I'm kind of the redheaded stepchild of fantasy genre.
Well, yeah, I mean, everything has different flavors. I'm kind of going along with the longer books, I guess. I only have one out so far, and that's Nightshade Unicorn Forerunner. I'm working now on Guardian, which is book two in the Nightshade Unicorn series. But when I first, my first version of the manuscript for Forerunner was 82,000 words. So I wrote the end early on in the process, and then I went back to right after the beginning and wrote until I caught up with myself at the end. And
yeah, I've done that a couple times too.
Yeah. When I finally hit that, like, whoa, I'm there. It was 82,000 words, but then through the editing cycles and adding a whole new epilogue on top of it. I wound up over 90,000. I'm looking for my manuscript right now to see how much that actually was in the end. But it doesn't matter. You mentioned you were spending a lot of time listening to audiobook recordings. So I understand you're currently having one recorded.
Every book I put out, I have a paperback, an ebook, and an audiobook. And the guy I have narrating the audiobook is Steve Fortune, and he's fantastic. He really hits sort of all the notes of my narrative style. And actually, I remember when I put out the Revenant and the Tomb, it was always intended that we'd put out a paperback and an ebook. And then one night I said to my wife, because we were trying to theorize what we could do. My wife was going, you should really put out a graphical novel. Kids love graphical novels. And I know a bunch of people who are like do comic books and whatnot. And so I went shopping around on the costs of what it would take. And I was like, I better go some other direction. And so then I was talking to my wife. How about we try putting out an audiobook? She goes, I think that would be a great idea. So, I researched and I looked into doing an audiobook. And we went with, I think it was Findaway Voices, and found a narrator through them. And it was actually the first narrator that came back with their audition tape. And I was like, this is the guy. This is the guy.
You said so. His name was Steve Fortune?
Steve Fortune, yep.
Maybe I'll check him out.
Yep. He's a Brit, and he's sort of an older guy. I was talking to him, and I said his narration sort of reminded me of Roy Dotrice, who did the Song of Fire and Ice stuff, the George R. R. Martin stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I really liked his narration, and he found out he actually knew the guy. He had met him a few times. Roy was also an actor as well, so he'd had a chance to meet him a couple of times, and I think he was in like a couple of stage plays with him or something.
Yeah. Well, I wish I could listen to these samples. I found him on Audible, but yeah. I can't do it right now while I'm recording.
Yeah.
So I'm actually just starting into going to signing events, and that mm-hmm. segues us into our topic for today's episode. But yesterday was my first one, was my first event.
Yeah.
And I shared pictures online and just kind of talking about what's going on. And somebody reached out to me and said he has a studio and wasn't sure if he was offering to record it or offering his studio for my use. And he said, well, maybe either or. But then we ran into the challenge that he's halfway across the country from me. But I met him when I was a teenager, and he's always been into recording stuff. So I don't know. Maybe he'll be able to help out. I think that if I record my own audiobook, and I might do it, I have this microphone that I'm using right now, which is an AKG 120 Perception, AKG Perception 120 USB. The USB is just the type of connection that it has instead of the XLR 3-point connection. Is XLR the correct? I think that's it. But
it's XLR. My kid's big into like the audio video stuff.
Uh-huh.
And he got me like the one of the more popular Shure mics. And it has an XLR output on it as well, as in addition to USB.
Oh.
So
this one is just plain USB, and that's great because I bought it 11 or 12 years ago. I had no podcast on the horizon at that time. I was actually just trying to record myself singing and wanted a decent microphone on a budget. And So
the thing about XLR is it was I personally think it was a bigger deal when audio was all analog. Mm-hmm. Because because what would happen is on long lengths, those cables would pick up noise. But when you're doing USB out from the mic to the PC, it'd be picking up noise because it's all digital. So you're not gonna be picking up stuff from the cables.
Yeah, and honestly, I don't know what XLR could do for me, except it would allow me to connect to a different infrastructure, connect directly to a different device. But here I'm connecting to the computer. So many things are in software these days, and with the USB connection, it's fast enough to carry the signal. And if you know anything about audio sampling, and I know very little, the human ear isn't really going to hear anything different going above a sample rate of 44 kilohertz. Although,
well, even at 40, it would be a tough sell. Like at 20K, it sounds kind of like an AM/FM radio, but when you start going above that, and a number of bits also makes a difference too. If you 12 bits mm-hmm. or above, nobody would be able to hear the difference, but the sampling really allows you to get more resolution. But 44, you don't hear about. They go up to 96, and I think it's like 128 is in there as well. Yeah. And it's like, for voice, that's freaking overkill.
Yeah. Well, and they did it all scientifically, like 44 kilohertz. That's how many samples per second. That's 44,000 samples per second.
Per second. Yeah.
And the human ear can hear less than 20 kilohertz, frequencies, frequencies, talking about, if you've heard, and I got my degree in music education, so I'm looking at this from a musician's perspective as well, where middle C is the C which is below A440. A440, that's tuned to a frequency of 440 hertz.
Yeah.
And the bottom of the piano, your typical 88 key piano, if it's tuned in just intonation, equal tempered tuning, not just intonation, that bottom A is 27.5 hertz.
Yeah.
And then the top, I don't remember how that is, but the human, every octave, you double the hertz, you double the frequency, and because it's a logarithmic scale, and the human ear falls short of 20,000 hertz, meaning that the highest pitch we can hear, unless you're some kind of freak, and that's awesome. My highest hearing, last time I checked, was about 16,000 hertz. I couldn't hear.
Well, the thing is that when you start dealing with a resolution, let's say if you're hearing at 20,000 hertz, if you're sampling at 44,000, you're only getting, I think it's like 2 to 4 samples, mm-hmm. 2 to 4 samples per cycle, which is kind of rough. And then when you actually look at the analog to digital converter that's actually inside your PC on most of them, which is a 1-bit, and I'm getting real technical here. It's like I forget what it's called, but it's a 1-bit sampling, I think it is. What happens is it samples stuff at a very rapid rate. And, mm-hmm. But the thing is it's because of the higher frequencies and the rapid rate. When you start getting way up into the higher frequencies, your samples start getting fairly crude. The thing is it's beyond a point. I think it's like 5 or 6K. Basically, all that stuff is I wouldn't say noise, but it's like artifacts or it's uh-huh. it's stuff that's not even music.
I'm not surprised. And people don't hear it; they don't notice.
Yeah,
even
yeah.
Even if the cilia in their ears are picking it up and wiggling, they're not attuned to listening to it. They don't notice it. I actually, so I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and I did a 2-year mission. And I spent 2 months in the missionary training center while I was learning Spanish. And there was this one room where they would bring us in and do devotionals and have meetings. And you'd have people from different countries, and they'd come in there and put on headsets if they didn't understand the language in which the meeting was being given.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's the speakers that were the sound system that was being used, or if it was the radio system for the headsets, but something in there made a lot of noise.
Oh, wow.
It gave me headaches, but most people didn't notice it.
Oh, really?
And I, you know, maybe I'm just weird that I can, or I was at that time able to hear a little bit higher, or maybe it's my clarinetist experience listening to high notes that made me more aware of it. But
well, it's probably that, but you're also younger. As you get older, your hearing decreases and declines.
Yeah.
So, and you know, you probably, and if you've listened to a lot of loud sounds like rock concerts and whatnot, that will take a toll on yours as well.
Yeah. So all that to say that the sampling of 44,000 hertz, people aren't listening in the 15K range. They're not really. Yeah.
Exactly.
So yeah, this microphone, and it's I can record it 24-bit samples, which means, as I understand it, that the sample, you know, it's sampling 44,000 times per second, and each sample is merely a check of signal strength. It's sound waves are pressure waves. That's what they are. And sometimes the pressure is stronger, sometimes it's weaker. And a microphone, whether it's a diaphragm or whatever kind of microphone, it's just measuring how much that thing is moving. If you have sound pushing against something that's suspended or whatever, the microphone that is recording digitally is only checking, like, at it's checking 44,000 times a second how far is the diaphragm depressed or not.
Basically it's the number of times that it chops up the waveform.
Yeah.
Or I should say the number of levels it chops up the waveform.
Yeah. And
so,
and 24 yeah. bits is enough to express 16,777,216 levels.
Yeah. Nobody's going to, you'd have a hard time at 16 bits.
16
telling
bits
the difference.
65,000.
Yeah. So nobody really has that good a hearing.
Yeah. Anyway, so how do we get to talking about microphones?
I don't know.
I mean, I like to, but conference or convention prep, event prep. I asked a question in the Rider Dojo and you had an answer, and I thought it was pretty good, and I thought maybe you want to talk a little bit about it. So,
well, the thing is that you know, when you're a self-pub writer and you're always looking for ways to increase your readership. Like when I got into this, I knew that I wasn't going to, my stupid little novella wasn't going to sell a million copies. At least, hopefully. Yeah. Surprise. You know, so, you know, you're always looking for ways of selling your books. And I'm in with a bunch of comic guys, and they all go to these comic cons. And one of them told me, a guy named Eric told me, you know, well, I know this one author, and she goes to these, you know, she goes to some of these comic cons, and she sells a lot of books at those. And I said, you should really think about that. And I'm like, oh, you know, okay, maybe I'll try that. So, my first actual Comic-Con was last year. I had gone to prior to that, I think it was in 2022, I went to a conference called BaseCon, mm-hmm. which, you know, that's kind of making the rounds nowadays, which, by the way, a lot of writer dojo guys go there.
Is that base as military base, or is that base the fish?
based E B A S B A S E D. I can never spell it without typing it. Con. But yeah, it's basically, it's a, I don't want to say a conservative, but it's a non-woke.
Oh, yeah. That kind of based.
Yeah. And I sold a few books there. I didn't sell a lot. So I decided, well, you know, maybe I'm going to try this convention thing, in 2003 after releasing the Wizard Stone. So I decided I was going to start small and kind of work my way big.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one I went to was a Comic-Con out in Houghton Lake, Michigan. And then actually, you get out to these more sort of rural Comic-Cons, and they're less about comics and they're more kind of like a sort of like a flea market.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so there are artists there selling, you know, craft stuff. There are people selling Pokemon cards, you name it. So it's like a big range, and there are people selling comics. Wasn't a lot of turnout, but I sold about 11 books. I mean, I think it was less than 100 people there.
Okay.
And I didn't know what I was going to be getting at. I didn't know what I was going to be selling. I know I sold more than I did at Basecon the first time. And so, so it was like, okay, you know, this actually wasn't bad. We made a little bit of money, and I sold out to, you know, 11 different people. And I got a lot of stuff prepared for it. My setup that I have now, it's pretty much what I had at this one out in Houghton Lake, Michigan. So then I went to BaseCon, and they didn't have enough room for the full table set up. And the BaseCon's kind of interesting where you can just put your books out, and there you don't have to worry about anybody taking your book and not paying for it. Everybody there pays for it. So, and I sold about 15 books.
Okay.
So, so I was like, oh, well, I sold more than the last one. So this year I figured I'm going to do about four. Four different events. So I signed up for one in Clawson, Michigan, which is near me. Another one in Midland, Michigan. And I have another one I'm going to it in West Branch, Michigan, called Superheroes Con, which is actually put on by the same people who did the one in Houghton Lake. And I'll be going back to BaseCon again. So the Clawson, Michigan convention, I put out my setup, put out my books and all that, and I sold maybe three books. I learned a lesson there is that that, you know, when you go to some of these more dedicated comic conventions, they're strictly for the comics and the toys.
Mm.
And they're not going to be too interested in buying your book. But then when we went to, and this was early this month, when we went to we went to Midland, we sold out. I went there with like about 60 books, and I reserved three of each title in the event that there were problems. We
sold out.
We were out of books. Yeah, we sold around 60. I was shocked, and I was kind of upset that I didn't bring more books.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's the same convention setup. It just had a very higher turnout, and there were more people interested in you know, buying fantasy books.
Mm.
So then the word kind of got around, especially as telling people about how I sold out. We were out of there. It was a 2-day convention. We were there Saturday all day, and I sold like, I think, about 2/3 of my stock, actually a little bit more. And then Sunday, it started at 10. We were sold out by 12:30. So then I wasn't going to sit around, so we packed up and we left.
Yeah.
So I was talking to another author, and we were kind of, he was asking me, how did I sell so much? And I'm like, oh, it just did. I sold more than I did at the last one. I mean, I sold way more, but I didn't hardly sell anything there. And he goes, and this guy's been doing this for a few years. He goes, you've sold more at that one convention than I did any convention ever. because he apparently went and went around to a bunch of different cons.
Yeah.
So I was like, so we sat there and kind of theorized about why. I'm not exactly sure why I did. I just think I had a product that, you know, attracted people's attention, and I think my prices were right that they wanted to pick up the book and try it. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a pretty standard convention set up. I got a tabletop banner with both of my books on there and like the little captions and reviews and ratings and all that. And then I have, you know, my books. I have book stands with display books on them. I've got a card holder with bookmarks, and we give away 2 bookmarks with every purchase. I have my business cards there, which actually are just a QR code that goes to my website. And a sign saying what the price is, and that's pretty much it. I also have like a bunch of pens. My wife got a bunch of pens on bulk with my name and website address on them. We give those away too. So and that's okay. That's it. That ain't much.
Mm-hmm. So you get the pens in you know bulk. You get probably a few dozen. So how much does it break down to per pen that you're giving out?
It was like 50 some cents per pen, I think I calculated it at. And we didn't get a few. We got like about 500.
Okay.
So I've got pens coming out my ears. I will probably have pens for conventions for the next 2-3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
You sent me your YouTube video where you you present your setup, and I'll link that in the show notes. But I watched it and I took notes, you know, because there were good ideas. Yeah. And I didn't want to lose any of these good ideas. And then I took that list and I adapted it slightly, you know, just as mm-hmm. as needs, as per my needs. But yeah, like you have your tote bins, business cards, yep. and holder, like business yep. card holder. Display books, book stands for the display books, yep. your pens, bookmarks, bookmark holders, your collapsible banner. Did you get that? Did Staples print that? Where did you get it?
No, I got that from, I think I got it either from Got Print or there's another one online. I think it was Got Print that I got it from.
Okay.
Yeah, you can get those anywhere.
Okay, you have a sign, you have a locking cash box.
Yep.
And so then I don't think you had this one, but I added a card reader and tap sensor.
Yes, that's true.
And blank book plates, you did have that.
Yes, I do bring those, and as a matter of fact, I've used those. I keep them, but I've used them twice. One person came in and already bought one book.
Mm-hmm.
And forgot to bring it. So I pulled out one of those book plates, a sign, it said here, it's got an adhesive back, put it on your book. So I was able to get signed both books for him without him having to actually bring one.
Well, I always have to make things painful for myself. Yeah. So I have book plates that I made myself mm-hmm. because I didn't want to buy book plates. I always try to do things on the cheap because I didn't always have a lot of money, you know, and I still don't have a lot of money, and I'm trying to take off with a new career. And I jumped in with both feet, to spare you much, but I left my job before publishing. Mm-hmm. I had a manuscript when I left full-time employment, and then three months later, my first book was out, and now I've set my release date for the second book 6 months mm-hmm. after the first book.
Yeah.
But like the book plates, I brought my bin in from the car. I had an event today, and I have another event tomorrow. So I would have just left the bin in the car, but I brought it in.
Yeah.
So I have my, so my table skirt is something else also.
Yeah.
I didn't want to pay for a table skirt because those things are expensive to get a custom one
we just,
printed. And
we just bought a tablecloth and threw it over there. I mean, the thing is that, and this is the one thing I've noticed about when the customers pass by, they're looking either directly at the books or they're looking at the banner. They're not looking at anything like the table skirt or anything.
Well,
so we just have a black tablecloth, throw it over there, and we're done.
Yep. Yeah. Black tablecloth from Walmart.
Yep.
$12. But I did want some kind of table skirt. So I thought about it, and I got a custom printed bed sheet, a fitted bed sheet. And
bed sheet.
It's more genius than I can give myself credit for because it works really well. I have a folding table that I found at Goodwill last year. I was not thinking about conferences when I did it. I was renting out rooms in my old house, and I had two tenants who didn't like each other. And in order to reduce the drama, while I was writing a book, I just went over to that old house to write my book there. And so I brought this little folding table that I found at Goodwill for $12. And it's 5 feet wide and 30 inches deep. And I don't remember, is it like 30? It's about 30 inches tall, give or take, whatever. But a twin fitted bed sheet stretches over the front of that quite nicely. And it's not perfect. And the print on it is a little bit too big. Like it reaches up over the top and it reaches under the floor a little bit. So I should have given it more margin on the image that I submitted to be printed. But it looks great. I stretched that over the front as if the table has COVID. And then I put the tablecloth on the top. And yeah, pretty good effect. But yeah, I took notes from your video and I got myself a cash box. I got the tap sensor card reader or whatever. I have copies of my book in this bin. So book stands, I tried to 3D print my own, but my 3D printer pooped and didn't, it failed the print, twice. Actually, no, let's say more like four times or five. I downloaded somebody's design and it wasn't going to work very well on my printer. Just because their design required it was unfolding. It folded up and so that it printed flat and then you would have to unfold it. But that meant that it covered a large surface area on the build plate, and that makes it difficult for my particular 3D printer. So I came up with my own design, started printing it. It failed twice. The first time I knew why and I fixed the problem. The second time I don't know why, so I decided I would change the nozzle, and now I can't find my spare nozzles. I need to order more nozzles.
So yeah, I got a 3D printer too, but I put it away for a while. Yeah. So
yeah. So I caved and I bought this little tabletop banner holder.
Yeah. From Staples. I have something similar.
And I have an old like plate holder that I'm using as a book stand.
Well, that's when I was looking at the book stands on Amazon, that was one of the things that they were recommending was plate holders.
Mm.
So, I mean, whatever does the job, I'm assuming. I saw somebody at before I went out starting hitting these conventions, I went to a Comic-Con in Port Huron and just kind of walked around and see, you know, kind of got an idea what I'd be getting myself into. And a lot of authors, one of them made their own book stand out of scrap wood.
Mm. Uh-huh. Yeah, you know, I thought about that too. I just...
Whatever it takes, it's all that matters.
And I have my little business cards thing, which...
Yep.
These aren't really business cards for me as an author. They're just for my one book that I have so far. And I have a receipt book in case somebody wants a receipt. I didn't get a tap sensor that can print a receipt. So
we have those too. But I've noticed that when people buy cash, they don't ask for a receipt. So
yeah.
And with the credit card, actually, a couple of times I had people when I was taking stuff for credit card said, no, I don't want a receipt. So, okay.
I wanted to show you my ebooks. So, you know, print codes from BookFunnel. You can do ebook sales in person. Somebody buys the ebook and you hand them a little card. So I did that, except I folded it. And so it's kind of like a book, and I'll try to mimic it really quickly, but they're inside my lockbox and the key is upstairs. So I'm not going to get them out, but, I can hand you the card, and it's a little folding thing, except what you see printed on there is the book cover. And then inside it has the download code.
See, I don't even bother selling ebooks. Most people want, at least I've only run into a couple of people who said, no, I only buy ebooks. In which case my bookmarks have a QR code for the actual link on Amazon on the back.
Mm.
So I just basically, I pull out like a bookmark for each book, and I hand it to them and say, here you go. You know, if you're interested, here you go. And I have gotten residual sales from them. So, and audiobooks too. Because the link goes to the Amazon site, they can go right onto Audible from there and get the audiobook. So
something else I've done yesterday and today, and you can tell me if you think this is a good idea. I don't remember, maybe I stole this from you, but I have my newsletter sign up sitting on the table. But if they sign up for the newsletter, I will immediately give them a discount on the, so I even have it on my sign here. Like the paperback gets discounted about 25%, the hardcover also about 25%, and the ebook 50%. And then maybe they don't want to buy a book, but that's fine, because if you sign up, then you'll enter a drawing, and at the end of the day, one lucky person either gets a free ebook, or I will go back through the books that I sold. I'll go through my charges on Square, and I'll refund you $3.99 off of the book that you bought, so that your paperback is now almost 50% off.
Yeah,
but
no, I didn't do that.
Maybe I'm wasting my energy. Like maybe it's not necessary. And
well, I'm a big believer in just keeping it simple. You know, if they like the book, they'll eventually follow me. So I don't worry about that. If they didn't like the book, they're not going to sign up anyways. So, and the ebook stuff, in my opinion, I mean, you don't try and get the ebook sold if you can, because that's actually, I think, a bigger margin for sales, but, you know, 9 times out of 10, they'll use, you know, I only buy ebooks as an excuse not to buy.
Mm.
But I mean, you know, it doesn't hurt to have it available.
Yeah.
You know, but, most of them come and they're either looking at that banner or they're looking at the book.
That reminds me of my time as a missionary. I went to Phoenix Spanish speaking, and sometimes, you know, it's not preferred to just go and knock doors, and just, it's not preferred to cold call, as it were. Sometimes, like, you have downtime and, well, what are you going to do? And so when we did knock doors, we would try to hit neighborhoods that looked like they would be heavily Hispanic, because we were there to speak Spanish with people. If we ran across gringos, they were usually more straightforward. If they weren't interested, they would say no thanks and send us on our way. But a lot of the time, the Hispanic people wouldn't want to be so direct. They didn't want to be rude, you know?
Yeah.
Which meant sometimes a frustrating brief conversation where we say, can we share a message about Jesus Christ? Like, oh yeah, sure. Not right now, you know, maybe another day. And so we're like, okay, you know, what day? When can we come by? Like, oh, I don't know. I'm always coming and going. And, you know, so we got the idea that what they said was not right now. And what they meant was I'm not interested. So here's I only buy eBooks. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you actually mean that. So here, you can buy the eBook right now.
Oh, exactly.
Oh, you don't want to. Okay. That's fine. You know, but
yeah,
we'll give them the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, but anyways, that's kind of why. Well, the other thing is I don't have any. I don't think I have anything set up to do direct sales yet.
Mm.
And part of it is that in order to do that, you have to set yourself up, at least in Michigan. You have to set yourself up as a business entity.
I'm going to cut the interview right there for now because it went long and we kind of drifted in topic, which is great because that means next week I can bring you an episode just kind of discussing all the minutiae that goes into publishing, all the little details that you wouldn't think about otherwise and wind up taking up a lot of the time from independent authors. But yeah, I think it was an interesting discussion and we'll give you that next week. We'll see you next time on the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast.